Chinese are coming to the communist nation of Cuba, and why that's significant is the first story we're explaining this Wednesday. I'm Carl Azus. Welcome to our viewers watching worldwide. The Caribbean country that's 90 miles away from U.S. soil has a turbulent history. In the 20th century, Cuba went from being controlled by one dictator to being controlled by another. Fidel Castro, who led the revolution to overthrow Cuba's government in 1959, aligned his country with the communist Soviet Union. Cuba became a communist country itself. Its government took control of private businesses and all aspects of Cuban life. That, combined with the Cuban government's human rights abuses, soured relations with the democratic United States. It put a trade embargo on Cuba, limiting Americans' ability to do business with the communist country and pressuring Cuba to make democratic reforms. When the Soviet Union was on the brink of collapse in 1990, it stopped its support for Cuba. The island lost billions of dollars in Soviet economic help every year, and that crushed Cuba's economy. In more recent years, its government has tried to improve conditions by loosening some of its economic controls while still keeping its grip on political power. Over the past 10 years, Cubans have been allowed to buy electronics and cell phones, buy and sell used cars, and stay in hotels. The country is in the news now because it just announced that Cubans will be able to start their own businesses or get jobs in most fields of work. Previously, Cuba's government would only allow private workers in certain fields, like barbering, repairing tires, or posing with tourists. And it still plans to prevent people from working in 124 different kinds of jobs, though it didn't specify what those jobs are. A CNN correspondent on the island says the Cuban government will probably keep total control over healthcare and the media. Still, the change will open up more than 2,000 different fields to Cuban workers. It's a major economic reform. It could lead to more opportunities and hope for Cubans. But the British Broadcasting Corporation reports that the changes are likely to happen slowly, as a lot of the country's current private workers are in the tourism industry, and that's been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic and the U.S. embargo. 10-second trivia. Which of these internet browsers was launched first? Internet Explorer, Mozilla, Safari, or Netscape? In 1994, the Netscape Navigator started helping people with an internet connection browse the World Wide Web. Netscape also introduced something called SSL, Secure Sockets Layer, which became the first internet standard for protecting people's private information. This, of course, gave rise to online shopping because before SSL, people were concerned that sensitive info, like credit card numbers, wasn't safe in cyberspace. In fact, in Amazon's early days, folks commonly called the company to give their payment info over the phone. Though online shopping has dramatically changed how people shop in recent years, it carries an additional challenge for retailers. There are more returns of things ordered online than things bought in the store. You might be surprised at what happens when you ship something back.
Free returns. Their customer's insurance policy for shopping online. But what happens to those returns after you give them back might surprise you.
So customers really believe that the product just goes into the black hole or ends up being resold to another customer. In many instances, that's not the case.
In reality, many of these products never return anywhere. Instead, they may end up here. Or even here.
You know, easily 25% of all these returns get destroyed.
In fact, returns have become such a headache for retailers that in some cases they're just refunding customers and letting them keep or donate the unwanted items.
The cost of getting the product back from the customer is much higher than traditional logistics getting the product to the customer.
Turns out, free returns are far from it.
There's a very large disparity between the amount of returns that happen from consumers that buy products online versus in the store. In a brick and mortar store, we typically get somewhere between 5 and 10% returns, but online we get north of 30% returns.
In 2020, the coronavirus pandemic pushed online shopping and returns to record highs. CBRE, a commercial real estate service, estimates that Americans will end up returning $70 billion worth of online purchases post-holiday season. That's a staggering 73% growth from the previous five-year average. Here's why that's a problem.
The entire returns business in and of itself is just extremely complex.
Big retailers already use data to improve the shopping experience on the front end. Walmart believes data should play a bigger role in the returns process, too.
We're constantly digging into the data to understand why customers are bringing stuff back. And we actually can solve a bigger portion of the end of the life cycle of the product by stopping the return from ever occurring. So if I know that I have an item that is low quality, we work with the manufacturer to fix it, or we quit selling it.
That's because accepting a return isn't always easy either. A warehouse optimized for fulfilling orders now has to receive a product and inspect it. Then someone needs to decide whether it can be resold or not. In the end, an online return can require up to 20% more space and labor than one made in store. Those costs are part of why Optoro, a return solution company, estimates that returning a $50 item can cost a retailer 59% of its sale price. Often, the math just doesn't add up.
Look, the best return is the one that never happens. But when it does happen, it's about stopping the return or finding alternate ways where the customer brings it back to handle the item, to handle the return.
And that's where liquidators come in.
So this is a product that came in one of these pallets.
Liquidators like this one are the middlemen between retailers and resellers.
We sort, organize, process, and figure out methods to get them to the right home. And that's really what we do here.
They buy returned merchandise, then sort and evaluate it before auctioning it to discount stores and authorized resellers.
You'd be able to resell them at a profit because you'd be purchasing them at a real fraction of what the actual cost is.
But some returns never make it to a liquidator.
Products ending up in landfills, customers don't really even think of that as part of the purchase process.
Every year, returns produce an estimated 5 billion pounds of waste in landfills.
It's generally risky to remind consumers how potentially wasteful their consumerism is. So in general, retailers are hesitant to lean too heavily into those kind of awareness campaigns.
The solution is complicated, but Walmart, for one, says online shopping could actually help reduce the number of returns made.
When a customer goes online and tells me I'm returning this item for these reasons, I'm more apt to harness the information than I am if you just walk into a store and drop it off.
And it's not just data. Tools like better sizing predictions for clothes and shoes can help reduce the likelihood a customer purchases the wrong size. AI chatbots can help answer customers' questions quickly and keep labor costs down for retailers. Even augmented reality is helping customers try out products before they buy.
It's been unmanaged for years. Return rates were allowed to grow at the rate of sales. But if you effectively manage this thing, you can control your fate of where this is going. Absolutely.
In an odd way, this is a partially self-correcting problem. As the return problem gets bigger for all these retailers, there's more financial resources available to fix the problem. So there's a happy outcome where less of this stuff ends up in a landfill just because there's more money to be made by keeping it out of the landfill.
Four score and 7 years ago, well, actually a lot less than that, was when an artistically inclined man in New York became dedicated to the proposition of sculpting snow. His latest effort has neighbors and passersby stopping, staring, and snapping pictures. Robert Schott says conditions were just right. First, there was snow. He wasn't traveling. He was healthy. He didn't have to commute to work in the city. And while his sculpture may perish from the earth, his community's admiration lives on. What a great way to be linking the past to the present. Maybe in future years he'll be biding his time, trying to trump his previous efforts, bringing Barack such a Georgist tradition that takes a clean ton of time, but still pushes him to begin afresh each year by cartooning out sculptures that never get Gerald. Presidential pawns, they command respect. Want to give a shout out to the Conrad Schools of Science, the students watching from Wilmington, Delaware, as we're well aware. I'm Coral Azus for CNN.